This is Seeking Delphi, episode 21, The Future of Privacy in the Digital Age. I'm Mark Sackler. The future lives here. Just hours before Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg faced a joint committee hearing of U.S. senators, I addressed the digital privacy issue in an interview with noted futurist and techno-philosopher Gray Scott. Scott hosts the web series Futuristic Now and has been frequently interviewed on his views of the future by media outlets as diverse as the Discovery Channel, Forbes, the New York Post, Fox News, the Washington Post, and many more. I reached him in his New York office, and some of what he had to say about the future of privacy, if there even is any in our future, may surprise you. Gray, welcome to Seeking Delphi, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Gray, in your background, you refer to yourself as a futurist, as I refer to myself, and I think most of our listeners understand what that is, although there may be different definitions of what a futurist is. You also call yourself a techno-philosopher. What exactly is that? How do you define it? And how does that relate to the subject matter in hand of privacy in our digital age?
Well, you know, the history of futurology goes back to the Russian cosmists, if you know your history of futurology. And so we have been called different names throughout history, some good and some not so good. But there seems to be a new trend moving towards digital philosophy or techno-philosophy. Those are the two fields that are sort of emerging right now. And it's just a branch, the way I see it, is just a branch of futurology that deals specifically with the sort of cultural impact that technology has on our psychological minds and our behaviors. Digital philosophers or techno-philosophers primarily deal with how we are perceiving technology and the changes that are happening as we move towards the future. So that's sort of the holistic way to explain it.
Gray, you recently did a YouTube Live event on this subject, the whole notion of privacy in the digital age. Tell us, just give us an idea what the gist of your message was before we get into some of the specifics.
Yeah, so, you know, I would say maybe 5 years ago, I said that privacy in the future would be irrelevant. And you know as well as I do as a futurist, a lot of times when we make these statements, people think that we're advocating for what we're talking about. But in fact, a lot of times what we're doing is actually giving a warning to people and saying, this is what's going to happen. Whether I agree with it or not is beside the point. And when I said that privacy in the future would be irrelevant, it wasn't that I was advocating for the end of privacy. What I was saying was that from all of my research and all of my observations, as a professional futurist, I could tell that that's where we're headed. We're headed towards a future where privacy just doesn't matter to people anymore because they're more interested in efficiency, making money, advertising, you know, getting people to sort of pay attention to them, this idea of attention theft, all of those things. And you could see it even 5 years ago. You could really see that this was building towards a future where privacy just wasn't as important to people. And what's happened recently with Facebook is a perfect example of this. I mean, people were willing to just put up online anything about themselves and reveal intimate details about their lives without paying the service to protect them. And they wanted this for free. And I'm just as bad. I did it as well. We all did. And part of what happens as we move further into the future is that we're becoming more digitized as a species. And so how do you wall off your code that represents you in the digital world from everyone else's? If you are in that world, those codes have to co-mingle. And so we may be looking at a future where privacy is literally impossible.
So in that YouTube live video, you said this runs a lot deeper than just Facebook or even all of social media and goes to a depth of who and what we are, what our values are as a species. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Well, part of what I was trying to get to in the YouTube video about privacy was that we need to try to understand what evolution is trying to tell us, literally trying to tell us through our DNA, through our instincts, how we got here, who we are, and where we're going. So those are deep, profound questions that we need to be asking ourselves as individuals, but we need to be asking ourselves as a culture and a species as well, especially if we're a species that wants to eventually get off this planet and colonize the moon and Mars. You do not want to take the kind of greed that we have right now on this planet. We do not want to take that to Mars. It is even more dangerous on a planet like Mars, because it would be very easy for one rogue bad actor to blow a hole in the space station and kill everybody. So we're really looking at a situation right now where the chickens have come home to roost, so to speak. I mean, we're reaping what we have sown with this privacy issue. I mean, if you look at the history of Facebook and how it started and how Zuckerberg behaved in the beginning, it's not surprising to me that this is where we've ended up, except he brought us all with him into this bad situation. And they have used advertising as their main source of income and micro-targeting as their main source of income. And that's dangerous for all of us, because what it does is it hijacks our attention. It pushes us towards paying attention to things that advertisers want us to pay attention to instead of going on to the service where it should have been about, and it should be about, genuinely connecting with real friends and family. That would have been an amazing service, but that is not what we have right now. And so the YouTube video on my YouTube channel was primarily about the deeper psychological aspects of privacy and where we go in the future with that. And if we don't resolve some of these monkey mind problems that we have as a species, these old, old, antiquated behaviors, what chance do we have in this digital tsunami that's coming towards us? What chance do we have to survive that?
So let's move on here and talk a little bit about some of the technology issues that are going to come into play in the near and more distant future. Starting with the Internet of Things, clearly as more and more things are in and around us and even on our bodies are connected to the web, have computerized or chip capabilities, more and more data is going to be out there. What's your take on all of this?
Well, so this is interesting. So IBM just came out with the world's smallest computer. It's smaller than a grain of sand. And that innovation, that moment that we've just discovered, proves that in the very near future, let's say within the next 5 years, that every object around you is going to be a computer. Every object will compute, and there will be sensors everywhere. Everything will be collecting data and quantifying not only the environment, but it will be quantifying your body, your behaviors, even your thoughts, because we know that breaking the brain barrier is where we're headed. We are starting to realize and go inward towards the inner self. And that IoT and IOE, the Internet of Everything, that's a very interesting spot to be in, because imagine coming home and you sit in your office chair in your home office, and your chair is reading your blood pressure, your chair is reading your heartbeat, your chair is reading your body temperature, it's recording your voice. It's so every object around you is picking up on data. And that data, if we don't deal with this privacy issue, if we don't deal with our value, our data value and what it's worth, And is it worth anything? If we don't start dealing with that, then suddenly all that data is exiting our environment. And who is collecting that? And how are they using it? And we're talking about extraordinarily private, intimate data. So that is a real concern. We're on the tip of that right now. I mean, a lot of people have smart home assistants in their home right now that can hear them, that can listen, distinguish their voice from other people's voices in the house. And these service contracts, that if you read them very carefully, you might be surprised in what you're agreeing to. Some of them may be listening to you when you've not authorized them to be listening to you. Some of them may be tracking your emails and reading your emails. And all of this is in pursuit of, going back to the hijacking attention, all of this is in pursuit of getting you to purchase something from an advertiser so that that advertiser can pay for that data and pay the company that's providing the micro-targeting. We need to change that. We need to, all of us listening to this podcast, we need to change that behavior. And the first way that we can do this is by showing true value to things that we value online. Start paying for services that provide value for you. That way you have at least a little bit more control over how they use that data. And the companies that are being paid for the service, let's say it's $5 a month to have some sort of app working for you, they're not as susceptible to the advertising business model because they already have money coming in. So there's a lot of ways that we can affect the future of privacy. And the first way is to start showing value to things that we care for.
I've heard it suggested by other individuals, including a couple who've been on our podcast, that the problem isn't so much the collection of data, it's the fact that it's controlled and owned by external forces, individuals, companies, enterprises, that we have no control over where it goes. Suggested not only should we be able to own it, but perhaps if companies have value in that, we ought to get remuneration for it, actually get paid for access to our data. How do you feel about that?
I think that's a great business model because then it goes back to the value of the data itself. I think having ownership of your data and having the choice to sell that to somebody for a specific reason, let's say it's a research project or let's say it's an insurance company that says, look, we will pay you for your quantified self data where we want to track you for the next 3 months and read your heart rate in social situations so we can, you know, make a profile on you and other people, and we'll pay you a certain amount of money. If people are willing to do that, and if they feel like that's, worth value to them, I'm not opposed to that. You just have to also remember that if you're doing that, you still are giving up that data, and that data is going out into the digital cosmos. So, and that, let's just be very clear here. When I talk about the digital cosmos, people sort of think it's meta and it's not, a real thing. But the digital universe, the digital cosmos, is a real place. It is real. It is a tangible thing that you can go to, you can tap into, and you can get information on real people and real subsets of people. So to say that this is a meta idea is just inaccurate. The digital cosmos is real, and each of us is tagged already in that world with this digital data. So I like the idea of being able to sell the data or at least have some sort of value connected to your own personal data. That way, at least you're in the bargaining. You're at the table bargaining, right? Right now, the way that Facebook has it set up, we're not at the table. All we're doing basically is feeding the system. And then everyone else, from the point that you upload your information, your data, from that point on, you're out of the negotiating loop. You have no say-so over where it goes, who gets paid for it, or how much they're making off of it. I think if people saw how much money Facebook has made off of each individual person, they would be shocked. They would be absolutely stunned how much your data is actually worth. Now, my question is, and we're talking about a company that has hundreds of billions of dollars. Why first of all, why do you need hundreds of billions of dollars? I mean, this goes back down into corporate structure, and that could be a whole show in itself on the fact that we've lost our way with how we've set up our corporations, that we value stockholders more than we value the individuals, and we value the company more than we value humanity. And so that's a very dangerous road. We're already on that road. And so some of these companies feel like they're forced. I mean, every content creator, I mean, I've felt this way with the stuff that I've produced, the content that I've produced. There comes a moment where when you're producing these shows by yourself, advertisers come along and they say, hey, look, we'll pay you $750 for an article on your website, or we'll pay you $2,500 to do an ad for us, or whatever it is, whatever the prices are. But in exchange for that, they want to take a look at your mailing list, or they want to take a look at some sort of data that you have as a subset. That's where it gets dangerous, because content creators are tempted to take that money. It's a short-term solution for a long-term issue, which is privacy. So I agree with people who say that we should be at the negotiating table when it comes to what our data is worth. And if we're going to sell it, we should get something serious for it, not a couple of $100s, especially when it comes to a company that has hundreds of billions of dollars. So we're not talking, you know, Facebook has never been a horizontal business model. They could be, and they could start paying people to produce content. They have started that as a pilot program for original content, video content. They've started to do that, but they're not paying people to produce daily content just on their timeline. That would be very expensive, but I think the cost of our privacy is even more expensive.
Speaking earlier about the Internet of Things, you mentioned the possibility of actually getting data directly from our brains. In one of my recent News of the Future this week blog posts, I linked to a story appropriately on Kurzweil.net, by the way, that a DARPA-funded project has successfully created a prosthetic memory that enhances near-term recall by 35% by writing directly into an individual's hippocampus. So really, this transhumanist future is rapidly upon us. What is it going to mean when we can actually communicate directly with our minds, with each other, and with the cloud?
Well, that's interesting, Mark, because it goes back to basically the premise of my YouTube channel and the show that I started, Futuristic Now. The original episode, the first episode was titled "The Future is a Portal Inward." And that sort of set the precedent for the entire show, because what I was saying to people and what I'm trying to say to people is that the future is literally moving us further inward. We've been told for a very long time that the future is this sort of outward, expansive, Gene Roddenberry style future where we're going out into the stars and we're exploring. But that's not what we're seeing. It's 2018. We're not on the moon. We're not on Mars. I mean, we have rovers, but we have no humans there. So what we're starting to see is that artificial reality, virtual reality, is becoming so indistinguishable from reality right now in 2018. We're just on the cusp of breaking that uncanny valley barrier. And so my theory here is that what's happening to us is that we're just moving inward. And all of the research that is happening on the brain and getting inside the brain and reading thoughts and reading memories and being able to visualize memories and all that stuff is happening is another sign that the future is not external. The future is actually internal. We're moving inward. And the transhuman part of this, the part that the transhuman community sort of is focused on, is merging with machines, right? That you hear that all the time from the transhuman community. And I think that is happening. We've been seeing that for a very long time. I mean, whether you talk about cochlear implants or titanium hip implants, all of those things are devices moving us inward, right? Repairing the internal body. And now we're starting to see technologies that are able to, for example, the University of Kyoto just came out with a report. It was the second time that they've done the study where they were able to record what people were seeing. Using an fMRI system, they were able to record what people are seeing inside of their minds, right? So they would show them an image, and then they would use a deep neural network program to output something that was similar to what they were seeing in their mind. So it wasn't a one-to-one correlation. It wasn't exactly what they were seeing, but it was an interpretation that looked very similar. But here's the most miraculous part of this study. When they removed the image that they were showing them and then later asked them, while they were hooked up to the fMRI system, to remember what they saw, they could still output what they were seeing. So what they have proven is that we can literally output on a computer screen memory. And that is just another example of this portal inward. We're moving as a species inside the mind. And the thing that worries me, and going back to this idea of privacy, is if we're moving internal, if we're opening our minds to the universe, basically, we better make sure that our fellow human beings are worthy of being inside of our minds. Throughout our history, the brain has been the final frontier of privacy. You could pretend to be nice, you could pretend to like someone, you could pretend to be happy, but you still had that last frontier of privacy, which was the mind. And now we have a portal into that mind with technology. And so I think it's very critical that we start paying attention to the things that have plagued us for a very long time. And this is what, you referenced the privacy video on my YouTube channel. That show was specifically less about, even, it wasn't even about privacy. It was about who are we and who do we want to be as a species? I mean, our psychology needs to evolve as quickly as our technologies are evolving. I don't know if that's even possible, but we should try to keep up with that. And instead, what you're seeing in our culture is the de-evolution of intellectualism. You're seeing people that are praising people who are anti-intellectual. And so are those the people you want inside of your brain, inside of your mind, that can hijack your attention and hijack your privacy and hijack your thoughts and use that to make money? So we have a lot of really serious pressing issues that are happening right now. It's not even futuristic, it's right now.
It's been suggested in some circles that blockchain, the publicly shared ledger in the cloud that requires all parties to agree on what has been transacted, that also kind of cuts out middlemen. That might have a role to play in all of this in the privacy issue. Where do you see that all falling out?
Well, I think blockchain is one of the solutions. I think there are going to have to be several, but I think blockchain is a good start to transparency, where if everyone is transparent, then, and to be in that system on the blockchain, you have to be a part of the ledger. So any interaction, and I'm using this in the privacy sort of reading thoughts and reading minds way of thinking about blockchain. If I put my thoughts into this blockchain and that is public, any changes that get made by some other person will be recorded and I'll be able to see it and the rest of the world will be able to see it. So there's an unlimited transparency that's there. So the playing field for privacy becomes horizontal instead of vertical, where only one person has access to our information and they make the decisions privately behind closed doors. So I think blockchain is there's a lot of good that could come from using blockchain systems when we talk about privacy. For example, if we use it for Internet of Everything, where before the data leaves your space or your body, that data is put into the blockchain so that no changes can be made. No one can view it without being seen, right? So there is a record, a transparent record for that system. So I think it's a good start. I don't know that it would work unless everyone, including corporations and people running governments, agree to it. And I'm not seeing that. I just don't see that. I think governments and corporations want to operate inside a bubble, away from the public view, so that they can make decisions without the public knowing. And we've seen that with Facebook, and we're seeing that even today. There was an article that came out this morning that I didn't get to read the whole thing, but even while Mark Zuckerberg is about to testify about privacy in his company, we're still discovering that they're still sharing data with companies that are trying to use that data to sell advertising to us or to use it for other purposes. So, you know, you'd have to get everyone to agree, and we've just never seen anything like that in our history, so it'd be very hard to imagine that could happen in the future.
Well, you're suggesting that maybe you're not so trusting of the motivations of corporations, and particularly of the government, is very timely, because even as the government right now is grilling Mark Zuckerberg and questioning the privacy breaches on that platform, they've passed the Cloud Act. The Congress passed something called the Cloud Act, which allows them to subpoena data from social media, from our cell phone providers, et cetera, even if that data is on overseas servers. So this is kind of a little bit of a concern, I think, as it could be open to abuse. And I'm curious how you feel about all of that.
You know, the Cloud Act is, to me, I'm torn about the way we discuss privacy, because the meta idea of privacy, the way I want the future to sort of unfold, is where we're all safe and trustworthy. That is this sort of utopian way of thinking about this. The dystopian part of this, which I think is how the Cloud Act is moving us towards more of a dystopian idea, is that there's nowhere where you can store your data that's safe, so that anything, any part of your quantified self or quantified environment or your thoughts in the near future, all of that will be accessible, and it will be legal for governments to look at that information. That is extraordinarily dangerous, that the realm of your thoughts could be, not to go into sort of tinfoil hat arena here, but I mean, we are getting to a place where it's starting to become legal for governments to get inside of your mind, and to a certain degree, in the next 5 to 7 years, you're going to start seeing people wearing EEG headsets that are going to be so advanced that you can start recording words and phrases just by thinking. And let's say it's a daily diary where you don't even really think about it. It's constantly recording your memories and your thoughts and storing that in a server. Who has access to that? And how do people feel about having a government say, well, we don't like the way that you're talking. We don't like the content that you're putting out there. And so we want to investigate your private cloud and read all of your private thoughts. And we're not talking about stuff that you consciously put up. We're talking about the unconscious recorded thoughts that have gone into the cloud. That's the future of social network. That's where we're headed, is the unconscious collection of thoughts in the future.
So one final question, and this is the $64 question, whatever you want to call it. The final question is privacy, as we've noted in the past, is it dead?
You know, people have said privacy is dead. What I said originally at the beginning of this conversation was that privacy in the future would be irrelevant. Not that it's dead, that people just wouldn't care. And I think that's what we're starting to see. It's not so much that it's dead, because the idea of privacy being dead is that there would be people mourning that death. right? People would be upset that they had lost their privacy. Well, what you're seeing now is that people don't even think about it anymore. It's just irrelevant to them. They don't care whether someone's listening to their conversations on their cell phones. They don't care if someone's reading their texts. They literally just don't even care anymore whether those things, where the privacy has been pierced and whether their thoughts have been hijacked. And so that idea of privacy being dead, I think is, I think we've moved beyond that. I think we've moved to a place where it's just irrelevant now. And I don't, again, like I said in the beginning of the conversation, I don't advocate that movement. I think we should have some private space. And I've always thought that the mind should be kept private. It is our only refuge. And we should make sure that the people that are penetrating that brain barrier, that we trust them. So on a technical level, I will say this as a final thought to this. I live in New York City, and there's no way that I can have a private life here. The moment that I walk outside of my front door, I'm being recorded. There are cameras everywhere in New York, and I have no idea individually, those cameras that you see on top of buildings, and anybody that lives in New York, if you look up, you will see cameras everywhere. We have no idea who gets that final recording, how it's being used. And so New York in itself is a surveilled city. It just is, because of what happened in 9/11. From that point on, we just became this ultra surveillance city. So privacy in New York is very difficult to have. But when you leave New York, when you're outside of New York and you move more to the rural areas, then you start to have a little bit more privacy. You can also be completely off of technology, but there's still technologies that will be able to get to you if they really want to get to you. So I will just, for the final thought, I guess I'll say that, again, I think privacy is becoming irrelevant to people. They just don't seem to care about it.
Great. Thank you for your time. And before you go, tell our listeners where they can see and hear more of Gray Scott.
Well, thanks so much, Mark, for having me. This has been great. Anybody that's listening can go to my website, which is grayscott.com, or you can go to my YouTube channel, which is Gray Scott Future on YouTube. And again, I have the new series called Futuristic Now. It's a digital philosophy, techno-philosophy series on YouTube.
Even as Gray Scott was asserting that privacy in our digital age may have become irrelevant, a story on the front page of the New York Times business section stated almost exactly the same thing. This is a subject that is not going away anytime soon, so look for further Seeking Delphi episodes devoted to this and related subjects in the months ahead. A reminder that you can subscribe to these podcasts on iTunes, Player FM, and YouTube, that you can follow me on Twitter at Mark Sackler, and if you're still so inclined, you can follow Seeking Delphi on Facebook. As always, my technical assistant is Mohammed Marouf. Thank you for joining me. Until next time, I'm Mark Sackler.